Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts.
How few of the human race have ever had an opportunity of choosing a system of government for themselves?
They're acting like they're bigger than government.
Mark Reardon.
Pay attention to science, 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 and science.
Whoa, whoa, slow down. I'm a scientist, and that was still fast.
The Mark Reardon Show is on now.
Well, I've made a pretty big mistake today. Dave, you're my witness, because I've made the mistake of trying to do math before the show. This is always a little risky. Actually, math in general is risky. And you've been back in the office with me. We're crunching numbers. I'll explain why this is important here in a second. But first and foremost, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Dave is here with us. Dave Klein in the studio. Sue Thomas is off this afternoon. She will be back on Tuesday. I, as a programming note, am off tomorrow. And Monday, off to a little jaunt to Las Vegas for a music festival called Life is Beautiful. By the way, speaking of music, you got my bumps in here today?
I do.
Stapleton tonight. And I'm not going because I'm leaving in the morning.
Oh,
and I really wanted to
stinks.
See the Marcus King Band. You don't want to miss the Marcus King Band. By the way, for people heading out to that show tonight, let me give you a little...
Where is that, by the way?
It's at the Amphitheater.
Oh, okay.
The doors will open at 5:30. Yola, who's fantastic as well. You know, sometimes you skip the warm-ups on this stuff. Don't skip the warm-ups. That's my advice. Yola, the first opener, Marcus King Band at 7:45, and then Stapleton goes on right around 8:55. So just keep that in mind. All right, so I had lunch and played a little golf with a friend of mine, my friend John, today. We were talking about some of this stuff related to COVID. And, you know, we all go back and forth, Dave, and have these discussions. And I... how many times yesterday in the news did you hear, or did you hear this reference to basically now we've had, I can't remember how they put it, but it's basically one in five, I think it's one in five people in this country have died from COVID. Have you heard that?
I heard something similar, yeah. Okay.
So because now you have 658,000 deaths. Google that real quick just to see what some of the headlines are, okay? Just Google like one in five. I just want to see if I'm getting the headlines accurate, because I heard this many times because we have 658,000 COVID deaths in this country right now. But I started looking at the CDC numbers. I heard this from the network news anchors yesterday. You know, you see it in some of the headlines. And I thought, well, let's break these down just a little bit, because one of the things we're going to talk about here in a very, very short time, in fact, in the next segment, is from David Zwig, who is an author in New York. He's a writer. He's written some nonfiction and fiction. But he had a piece in The Atlantic about how the most reliable pandemic number that we have, which is the hospitalization number, is kind of losing meaning, because you have almost half now of those hospitalized with COVID-19 have mild or asymptomatic cases. In other words, some people are getting counted in this because they have asymptomatic cases, but they're in there for a different reason. So he's going to break it down in just a minute. But when you look at these numbers...
And by the way, it was one in every 500
okay,
U.S. residents have died.
That makes more sense. But still, that's an important number. Thank you.
Right.
I'm glad we looked that up. One in every... Now, that sounds scary, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That sounds really scary. One in every 500 people in this country have died. Until you kind of take a look at the numbers in a different way. Because if you look at those over the age of 85, no offense to those of you who are over the age of 85, but you're dying at a much faster rate. You're dying at a much faster rate in general because you are older. So 187,342 people have died in this country over the age of 85. Between the ages of 75 and 84, 176,763. Between the ages of 65 to 74, 147,568. Now, Dave, I added all those up on my little handy-dandy calculator on my iPad, and I came up with a number of 511,673. We did the math on that. That is approximately 77% of all COVID deaths in this country are those people over the age of 65. Right?
Yep.
Kids are barely affected by this. We know that. Now, what the fear porn people will tell you is that, well, wait a second here. Now kids are in the hospital and they're dying and we have to do something about it. So let me reference this. I want to toss this in here today because there's a story that's in the Washington Post today and it says, parenting a child under 12. Dave, you can relate with this. Parenting a child under 12 in the age of Delta, it's like a fire alarm every day, okay? So they talk to this guy, Greg Otto, conducts risk assessments. Hang on a second, I'm going to click on something on my computer. For a living. But the cybersecurity consultant from Springfield, Virginia, never imagined he'd have to do one every time his daughter, six, and son, four, stepped out of the boundaries of their home. Playing with the next-door neighbors outdoors, acceptable. School, necessary. Eating out, no way. Now, these are people who are not in touch with reality right now. They simply aren't. And I think it's frightening. It's not unlike the people who think that the climate is going to cause the planet to go away in just a few years because they are troubled mentally, like Greta Thunberg. And I feel that Greta in particular has been abused by her parents, which is of great concern to me. I don't put all of that on her. Dance classes where everyone is masked. This is for a 6- and a 4-year-old that were prepaid in June when the outlook for coronavirus infection seemed more optimistic on the fence. Parenting a child under 12 can be maddening and scary during normal times, but the Delta variant has taken things to a new level. With a vaccine for children ages 5 to 11 unlikely to be approved for at least a few more months, parents of young children are weighing a dizzying array of variables every day as they try to navigate the risks of COVID against the mental health and physical consequences of social isolation. And this story goes on and on, and it talks about all these things. Well, here's the problem with the Washington Post, and this is really the problem in the entire pandemic. People are not told the truth of what is happening out there. Now, clearly, you have more kids now who have died of COVID than earlier in the pandemic because of Delta. The total number of kids under the total number of children under the age of 17, 439. Well, Dave, if you could just save one, right? If you could just save one. Now, your kids are very young. My daughter is 6. We worry about our kids. But under 1 year old, 105 children have died from COVID. 344 have died from pneumonia and COVID. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Yeah, that was confusing.
That's in the CDC list. 22 have died from influenza. In that age group, all sexes, 0 to 17 years, 439 was my figure. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
188 have died from influenza. 103 have died from pneumonia. So that is 291, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes.
Wow, I got that right. So 291 to 439. Well, Mark, you can't give someone the flu or, well, yeah, you can actually. You can infect other people with the flu because the argument on some of these things is because I can bring something else into the mix. I haven't checked this, but I would almost promise you that the number of children who have died in swimming pools or in lakes by drowning this year has exceeded the number of COVID deaths. Now, I don't know that for sure, but I've looked at this in past years. Well, so, Mark, you're just dumb. You don't understand that you can't go to someone's pool and, you know, I can't if I murder the kid, right? But I just being there in their presence or breathing the same air can't force the child to drown. I understand that. So are these analogies perfect? No, but my point is that with pneumonia and influenza, if we're this freaked out, we've never been this freaked out. There's never been a story in the Washington Post about parents trying to navigate the tricky waters of pneumonia or the flu, which have existed every year and kill a fair amount of children. And I would say, by the way, these flu numbers are probably lower, if I had to guess, just because you do have more precautions.
Right.
So, you know, we can match these up from year to year, but people are not dealing with the reality of where this pandemic is hitting people. Now, Okay. Do you have long hauler symptoms? Do you have some things that are unknown? Absolutely. The other thing that I'm not telling you here, because I don't have the specific breakdown of the 439 children, what percentage of those kids were obese? What percentage of those kids had asthma? What percentage of those kids had other comorbidities? I think that's important. Are healthy kids, 4, 6, under the age of 12? Let's focus on them because they can't get the vaccine. Are they even getting sick at a rapid rate? They are not. And if they're getting sick, it is mild. So we cannot operate. This is, we've done everything backwards in this pandemic from the very start. We operate from the exact opposite assumptions. And we did it from the very beginning with masking, right? Well, you don't need to wear a mask because it's not going to help you. Well, now we feel like it's going to help you. We don't know that it's going to help you, but we better tell you to wear your mask, right? Well, then it didn't really help people unless they had N95 masks on. And now everyone's confused because the cloth masks, people still think the cloth masks work. They do not. I mean, the research, you can throw numbers at me all day long, and I encourage people to do that if you doubt my breakdown of what the numbers are showing right now. But the bottom line is most of the people who are dying are older people. Most of the people who are in the hospital are older people. Most of the people who have issues with this have comorbidities. They are not pictures of health. We've known that from the very beginning. But we're trying to protect the youngest people with policies made for the oldest people that don't apply to the younger people. I don't even know if that made sense.
No, it's kind of backwards. Yes.
Yeah, it is backwards. Yeah. So where, and I've always offered this example, and I think we're going backwards in this particular area as well. We have some pretty good science here from multiple studies from across the planet that you simply cannot spread this thing outdoors. It's very, very rare. Now, would I say being outdoors in a group setting at a concert, shoulder to shoulder, for example, like people at the amphitheater tonight, is that different than just being outdoors in a park? Well, maybe it is. Okay. Is it different than being in Mumbai at a street market where there's thousands of people? Yeah, it is. I think it is. We don't have situations. We certainly don't have that situation in this city or in this state where we have crowded, congested, you know, streets. There's nobody downtown. For those people who haven't been downtown, there ain't nobody here except for criminals downtown St. Louis.
Or for the Harry Styles concert.
Right.
That's about it.
Or people running red lights on a regular basis and, you know, doing all these things. So there's nobody downtown. You know, I mentioned Bill Burr's coming to town in a couple weeks. I can't wait for that show. The last time he was here, and this was before the pandemic.
I remember this.
He opens the show at the Fox and he goes, St. Louis. What's going on? He goes, do they film The Walking Dead here? 5 o'clock downtown. There's nobody out. What is the deal? And that's basically what.
And he's not wrong.
He's not wrong. So I don't know. And this is what's going to be interesting, I think, about the conversation coming up here with David. Because these numbers at some point aren't going to mean anything. And I think we're at that point right now. You see the hospitalization numbers. You see the number of people who are testing positive. Those are all meaningless numbers. We should focus on the more meaningful numbers with this pandemic. And we should have been telling people, as I've said multiple times, go outside. Get outside and get away from people. Don't go to crowded spaces. You know, your mask isn't going to help you in your crowded space. How do we know that? Well, because a lot of people get this with their masks on, and maybe it's going to. So let's say this. You got 100 people that are in a restaurant, right? And everybody is masked up, in theory, okay? The studies that have come out recently, and the one from India most prominently, would say, well, 10% reduction is possible with those masks. So that means that if 100 people in that room, and I don't even know how many people might get COVID, but you're going to have a 10% reduction. So let's say everybody gets COVID. You got 20 fewer people that are going to get, or 10 fewer people that are going to get COVID. That adds up over the course of time. You start expanding that into the thousands, the tens of thousands. You are reducing the number of people. But all things aren't equal with masking. And you can't just go out and wear your mask and virtue signal and walk around and go into Schnucks where nobody's gotten this thing and go into Walmart where nobody's gotten this thing and then act when you're around your friends the way that you always have. Now, again, I don't want to be misinterpreted here. I'm not telling people to wear N95 masks 24 hours a day. That's ridiculous. It's not realistic. But the bottom line is, and I think at this point the medical experts might even have to admit this, is the masking is only helping you if you have that thing around your nose and mouth, you're not touching it, You make sure that you change it throughout the course of the day and that you have an N95. What percentage of kids right now in Rockwood schools, in Parkway schools, are wearing N95 masks and they're not taking them off throughout the course of the day? And by the way, the other thing is, on my restaurant analogy, okay, let's talk about restaurants in particular, because we had the woman from Ray's Cafe on last week, and I experienced this when I was in the suburbs of Chicago. Got your mask ordinance in Illinois. You go up to the restaurant, you check in, you got to have your mask on. They're wearing their mask, right? Got to have your mask on. You go in, you pull it off right away. You get to your table, you never put the damn thing on again.
Yeah, I never really understood that.
Right, because, Dave, it doesn't make any sense, and none of it really ever has. But the people who are scared to death, and I feel sorry for you if you're in the group that has been written about by that guy at the Washington Post about parents that are freaking out. You got to take a step back. There are all kinds of risks for your children out there. This is not a significant risk. COVID is not even close to a significant risk for your young kids. And I parents are acting opposite.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today. She fell in love.
Ah, there we go. A little Stapleton for the show tonight at the amphitheater. This might be one of my favorites off the album. Arkansas. Took a 911 about 107 down a back road. Well, did you see Stapleton before, Dave, or not?
I have not.
I saw him last time.
He's
he
on my
at
bucket
the
list.
Amphitheater. Yeah, really, really good. People are going to have fun. But again, don't miss Yola and Marcus King Band as well. Are you going to watch the Ali doc that's going to be on PBS?
Oh, for sure.
I'm very excited about it. I'm a fascination with Muhammad Ali, and Ken Burns did this documentary with his daughter, Sarah, and Sarah's going to join us in just a few minutes at 3:45 to talk about that documentary, and I guess we'll ask her about living in the shadows of her famous father as well. David Zweig is with me this afternoon. He's a writer based in New York, the author of the nonfiction book Invisibles and a novel called Swimming Inside the Sun. But he wrote a piece that caught my attention in The Atlantic, and the headline was, "Our Most Reliable Pandemic Number is Losing Meaning." I'm going to have David explain that to you this afternoon. David Zweig, how are you this afternoon? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I just spent a good chunk of the monologue here just talking about numbers. And I try to keep these things, you know, somewhat in perspective, which I think is very difficult. But we've had numbers that have been thrown at us now, a lot of different numbers, for the last 20 months, and it's getting more difficult to digest them. But your point was that one of the numbers that we've looked at, the media has looked at, I've talked about and shared with my audience, and you see it on CNN and Fox, is the number of those who have been hospitalized. But that's changing again, too, because there are different circumstances, aren't there?
That's right. Yeah. And what I wrote about for The Atlantic was there was a massive study done of close to 50,000 hospital admissions. And what the researchers found was that half of the admissions were for people who had either mild or incidental, meaning they were there for something other than COVID, but they tested positive for COVID upon admission. That half of what we see on these dashboards that are available online, or when you hear the media or public health authorities talk about COVID hospital admissions, that at this time, roughly half of them are not for people who are serious or even moderately sick with COVID.
Okay, now that's a pretty significant number. Even if you're in like 35-40%, that's pretty, and we're higher than that. So that seems to be something that's relatively important to discuss, which is, I'm assuming, why you wrote a column about it, right?
Yeah, I thought this was pretty stunning, and that's why I jumped on it, and I had a scoop on this article, on this study. Now, I should mention the study is not peer-reviewed yet. It just came out, but I thought this was so important that I did want to bring it to the public's attention. One of the reasons I felt comfortable writing about it is that a few months back, I wrote about two separate peer-reviewed studies on pediatric hospital admissions for COVID, and these findings really echoed what those two other studies found, where they found between 40 and 45% of the pediatric admissions were basically incidental. So you have a kid who shows up with a broken ankle or appendicitis. The hospital, as a requirement, they test every single admission. It turns out just incidentally that the person tests positive for COVID. And the hospitals have to, by the government law, they have to tell the government every single patient who is COVID positive. They don't differentiate how severely ill or they are or are not, nor do they differentiate whether it's an incidental infection. Like I said, someone shows up for something else. So what I think's really important and interesting for listeners to be aware of is when you hear public health authorities talk about the hospitalizations, or you see, screaming headlines in the media, be aware what this study at least found. And again, it's not like an anomaly. Now is echoing what these two pediatric studies found, is that roughly half of these admissions are for people who are not only not severe, but they use very specific metrics. They weren't even moderately ill.
Okay. Now, David, let's match what you just said and what you shared with my audience and your piece up with this. Mm-hmm. And I brought this up because I want your reaction to this. Maybe you saw this earlier. Headline in the Washington Post today, and I have a six-year-old, by the way. Parenting a child under 12 in the age of Delta, quote, it's like a fire alarm every day. The subheadline is routine outings become tricky decisions for the youngest Americans who are still ineligible for the coronavirus vaccine. That is the biggest piece of fear porn out there. And then it scares parents because, look, I'm afraid of everything that might happen to my daughter. But there's nothing in that piece that puts this whole pandemic, especially the risk to children, into proper context.
I am familiar with the article you are referring to, and I, spit out my coffee when I saw them. Let me say this, and hopefully this can, reassure your listeners. The risk to an unvaccinated child is lower than the risk to a vaccinated adult. So the notion that if you are a parent or you have a family where the parents are vaccinated and they're relatively living their lives normally and feeling okay about things, but they're freaking out about their kids, hopefully this will help them put things into perspective that even if a child is unvaccinated, they are still at lower risk than a vaccinated adult.
I think that's a very, very important number to throw out. And I'm going to put that one in my toolkit to use and to share with people because I think it's valuable. How do you, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at some of the pediatric numbers recently, because I went over these a little earlier in the show as well. And as of today, and obviously people are talking about how we have 658,000 deaths under the age of 17, 439 kids. But when you look at the charts, it's interesting because they also have pneumonia that's in there. So some kids are dying of pneumonia. Is it related to COVID? It might be. That's why they include the numbers. But obviously now you have flu totals and flu deaths in here as well. And under the age of 17, you've had, let's see here, a fair amount of kids that have also died of the flu. I'd have to see if I can find my numbers there. But the point is that these numbers all get jumbled up into one big group, and it sounds scary when often it's not.
Yeah, well, a couple things to that point, and this sort of dovetails with the hospitalization numbers article. You know, I've written about, generally, I only write about kids and COVID in schools, so this is right in my wheelhouse.
Good. I'm glad to hear
talking
that.
About. Yeah, and that's been my area, and I'm writing a book on the topic as well. So if anyone's interested in this, please come. I'm easy to find online, David Zweig. That's my Twitter handle, or you can go to my website and sign up for my mailing list or follow me on Twitter.
Z-W-E-I-G. Just want to make sure people
heard
the name.
That's right. Yeah. Z like zebra, W-E-I-G. But what I'm focusing on is why kids in America, why our policies are so drastically different from where they are in much of the world and in particular in Europe. And let me help put those numbers in perspective for you and some of the listeners. You know, in, I think it was 2018, 2019 flu season, and I don't have it in front of me, so I might be off by a little bit, but it was something like 477 kids died from the flu. Now, we are looking at, that's in a small window of time, it's just the flu season. We are now at more than a year and a half of COVID, and the numbers are still less than they are for the flu. And we obviously don't have kids wearing masks for the flu every year. We don't, you know, quarantine, all that stuff. It's this sort of classic rule, if you're sick, stay home. So the idea that COVID presents a, you know, horrible risk, as that Washington Post article you're referring to indicates, is just the numbers just simply don't reflect that. COVID is real. Kids do get sick, some of them, and unfortunately, some kids have even died. But when you place this in the context of influenza related to kids, it's not even close. And there's also, for a while, there's been a wave of something called RSV, which is another respiratory infection.
Right.
And that's been kind of rampaging in a lot of pockets of America. And from speaking with a number of physicians who I talk with on a regular basis, that there's a fair amount of what's known as co-infection, which you have a kid show up at the hospital. They may have RSV, which actually is dangerous to particularly to very young kids. And then just coincidentally, they may also be positive for COVID. So once again, that gets ticked off in the box as a COVID hospitalization, even though it's entirely possible or likely that it's RSV or some other respiratory infection that actually is the reason that the kids had to go
now
to the hospital.
Do you know how pneumonia plays into that? Because when I was doing my math earlier, I was looking at these charts from the CDC, and I was a little confused by the pneumonia totals because they have some in there, but it looks like they're combining some kids, or some people, they don't only do kids, they're dying of pneumonia, but they also have COVID. So I don't know what the correlation or relation is between pneumonia and COVID. They're both infections. They affect your lungs. I'm not sure how they separate that out.
Right. Well, you know, there's two different types of pneumonia. There's bacterial and viral pneumonia. But oftentimes, if you have an infection, like a respiratory infection to begin with, that can lead to pneumonia. So you could have the flu and then get pneumonia after that.
Right.
I haven't looked into it specifically with COVID and pneumonia, but I'd imagine that that also can be a correlation. That once again, these are multiple things that someone can have at the same time.
So let's go back. Let's circle back, come full circle here. The piece was our most reliable pandemic number is losing meaning. You're right. You've put this into very easy to understand perspectives here. How do we, when I say we, shouldn't health professionals frame it in this way moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a really important point. That's kind of one of the things that I'm always concerned about, which is there's nothing, I should note, there's nothing sort of like nefarious about them coding the patients this way. There's a good reason for it. It's because the government is trying to track the spread of the virus. So that's why they want to know how many people are arriving at a hospital. It's just one other way to track it. And hospitals need to treat those patients differently, perhaps isolate them differently, even if they aren't there because of COVID. If they find out they are COVID positive, that's something they need to know. So it's not that they were doing this with ill intent, but here's where the problem comes in. But then they need to inform the public of that, because the average person, when they hear about COVID hospitalizations, their mind, they interpret that to mean people are really sick with COVID and now they're in the hospital. So instead, the public health authorities need to say there should be a giant banner on top of these dashboards, and any journalist who's writing about this should say, these are people who are showing up with COVID. A significant portion of them are not necessarily there because of COVID. They're there with, but not from. So you need to inform the public. And to me, that's been the biggest problem of the pandemic is, it seems to me, and I do a lot of research at looking what different European countries are doing, and the lack of nuance in both our public messaging and in our public policies is really an anomaly, that everything is this blunt sort of binary messaging about what's happening. So I'm not here to minimize the deaths from COVID or to say that it's not serious, but rather to sort of turn the dial down on some of the, you know, hyperbole and the kind of, you know, hyperventilating that you see, you know, metaphorically in these media headlines like that one you read. If someone is a parent and they're worried about their kid, you know, getting COVID, I would caution them to not put them in the car, to not let them go swimming, because far more kids die in car accidents, die drowning each year, than they have of COVID. So we need to just put these risks into a perspective. It doesn't mean to ignore them. It doesn't mean they're not real, but it means we need to understand how they relate to other risks. And other countries are treating this very, very differently from how we are here in the States.
David Zwei, you're a fantastic guest. As I can't get the words out. Fantastic guest. I really appreciate it. I retweeted the piece. They can follow you. You can follow me at Mark Reardon, KFTK, and I put a link to your piece up there. I really appreciate it. We're going to have you back, I promise. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Take care.
Was an activist who fought to move America in a certain way.
I have too much to fight for, cause to fight for.
There was going to be an enormous price to pay for that.
Boxing was this much of his evolution. The person he is today is way bigger.
The price of freedom comes high. I have paid, but I am free.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. It's a new four-part PBS documentary film, Muhammad Ali, and Sarah Burns, co-director of the series, with us this afternoon, 97.1 FM Talk. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good, Mark. How are you?
Do you have any kind of lineage in filmmaking, parental lineage, or anything along those lines that you could maybe remind us of by any chance?
I am in the family business, as it were. My dad is Ken Burns, and we, along with my husband, David McMahon, have been making films together for more than a decade.
Well, I've interviewed your dad many times over the decades, and he's an okay interview, but I think you might be better, so we're going to roll with it here this
afternoon. I don't know about that.
Well, I'm excited about this because, and this is a film, maybe you've seen, maybe you haven't, as a documentary filmmaker, but there was one that stuck with me from 20 years ago called When We Were Kings, about the Rumble in the Jungle, and I mean, that's one of those movies that just has stuck with me. I think every child in America of a certain age, teenager, should be required to watch that. And maybe the same thing with your film here. So tell me about this documentary and what you focus on in this four-part film.
Yeah, When We Were Kings is a great, great film. And, you know, it focuses on a single fight. It's about the Rumble in the Jungle and the whole sort of everything around it. And what we were trying to do with this film, because there are so many great films already out there about Muhammad Ali, was to pull all the different parts of his story together. So this is 4 parts, 8 hours. We did the deep dive. It's an intimate portrait. And we wanted to, I think, find things that people, even people who know Ali's story really well, hadn't seen, hadn't heard before. And also just tie all those different pieces together. So it's, yes, it's about the boxing. There's lots of boxing in there, but there's a lot more than that too. You get the family story, the childhood, you get his faith, you get his draft resistance, and how all those things are interconnected throughout his life.
So one of the things that I'm a huge documentary fan, I always tell people because I've promoted films and have been a part-time critic for 3 decades, but there's so many documentaries that are far more entertaining and interesting than your mainstream Hollywood films. And a good documentary, you don't have to care anything about the topic. You don't have to be a fan of boxing to enjoy When We Were Kings. You shouldn't have to be a fan of boxing to enjoy this film either, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I will admit, maybe don't tell anyone, that I'm not a boxing fan. I certainly wasn't coming into this. I didn't know much about boxing. I knew things about Muhammad Ali. How could you not? He's so culturally significant. But I really knew very little about boxing. I've certainly learned a lot more about boxing, but I'm not going out and watching the, you know, heavyweight championship fights now. But in the story and telling and pulling all those parts of the story together, what happens is that you care about your guy. You care about Muhammad Ali so much. Because of everything he does, because of his cleverness, his way with words, because of his pride and determination, because of his courage, and the way that he brilliantly sets up every fight. He's a born promoter. And so each fight, he is the one creating the narrative around it. This is about Christianity versus Islam. This is about who is the most authentically black heavyweight. You know, he just creates these stakes for every fight. And so there, it's always about more than who wins or loses in the ring. And so you care so much about what happens. And for me, I learned a ton about boxing, and I really get invested in those fights, even though I'm not in love with boxing, but yeah, I am in love with Muhammad Ali.
So I've been to Louisville, Kentucky many, many times over the years for Kentucky Derbies, Breeders' Cups, was there over the summer. I always am on Muhammad Ali Boulevard, and I see the museum. I've never stepped into it. But Louisville is a huge part of this story, isn't it?
It is. I mean, his childhood in Louisville really shapes who he is. It's in good ways and in bad. You know, I mean, he experiences Jim Crow segregation in Louisville, and that impacts him in a huge way. He's very aware of it as a child, the places where he's not welcome. And that is really hurtful to him. And his father is frustrated and angry by the limited opportunity that he has as a painter. And so that informs his childhood and his life. But it's also, he grows up in Louisville's West End, which is a black community with a lot of middle-class black families that is a safe place for him, that is this welcoming, like, wonderful community. And so there's also these really positive ways that it shapes him. And also you get the Louisville sponsoring group, these white, wealthy men from Louisville who helped to launch his professional career by giving him what is at the time the greatest contract in the history of boxing. And so Louisville really shapes him, and also now, even if they didn't always, embraces him in this huge way, as you said. I mean, his funeral in Louisville when he died in 2016 was like a state funeral.
I mean, I've dabbled a little bit with trying to make a documentary and had a panic attack just thinking about the archive material that I might be required to have. I can't even imagine how much you guys have in a situation like this. But is there anything that you discovered, a piece of film, a picture, something that really stands out for this particular project, Sarah?
Yeah, you're right. The archival research is a huge part of what we do, and we have an amazing team in-house that does all of that research, that does this deep dive trying to turn up stuff that even people who know Ali really well haven't seen before. And so some of the really exciting discoveries are those things, the stuff that is unique that nobody's ever seen. So there's some footage from a neighbor of the Clay family in Louisville, some 8mm home movies that had never been transferred before that we have that are really intimate and charming. And then another great find that our producer Stephanie Jenkins turned up at an archive in Pennsylvania is some 16mm color film that the archivist there basically fished out of a dumpster. I mean, it was being abandoned by a production company. She found it, put it on a shelf somewhere, and our producer found it there and hand-cranked through it to see what was on it. It said Ali somewhere on it, and it turned out to be color 16mm footage of the Thrilla in Manila that nobody had ever seen before. And it's gorgeous. Yeah. And amazing. So that stuff is always really exciting.
That had to be exciting. So it premieres. Muhammad Ali starts on Sunday night. Is that true?
That's right.
8 p.m. here in St. Louis, KTC. It's 4 nights. And then, of course, I think you can stream it after that. Or can you start streaming it right away?
Yeah, on the 19th, it'll be available for streaming on the PBS website.
Will all four parts be up there, or are you just going to do it day by day?
No, the whole thing is, I think the whole thing will be up on Sunday.
I always ask just one other quick question. I always ask my documentarian friends who come on the show, are you or do you have the fabulous film festival that they do in Columbia, Missouri, on your radar as a documentary filmmaker? Because the True False Film Festival is fantastic. Have you ever been?
It is. I did get a chance to go once. I loved it. It was a really fun trip. I went there with the Central Park Five film we made more than a decade ago.
Well, yeah. Sarah Burns, I'm telling you, you got to tell your dad. He's okay as an interview. He's a great filmmaker, Sarah. You're right there with him as an interview, maybe even a little better. You tell him that. That guy in St.
Thank you.
No,
I will.
You're fantastic. I wanted to get you on because I'm really excited about this project because I have this fascination with Muhammad Ali. So I can't wait. Start Sunday night. Appreciate it, Sarah.
Thanks, Mark.
Vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.